Dave, I got to tell you this story. My wife has been working a different shift at work, so she comes home a little bit later in the day than she used to. And so I'm sitting at home with the with my two boys. We're in the living room hanging out. She walks in, and I turn my head, and I say, "Well, hello, my little sun-dappled rosebud." And, and my youngest son turns to me and says, "Dad, why are you talking to Mom like she's Dave Kellen?"
we gotta give some context for that. So
I figure we'll just throw that out there without context.
Just a no context joke there. So when Brad and I call each other, and I don't know how this got started, but it's been going on, Brad, wouldn't you say, for well over a year, maybe a year and a half.
At least
a year. And whenever we call one another, it's not like, "Hey, how you doing?" We answer the phone or start the phone conversation by going, "Well, hello, my little sweet sun-dappled pear," and the other one will say whatever the other one did.
And the object of the game, the unspoken object, is to see if you can make the other guy crack up harder than the first guy. And of course, the person making the call has a slight advantage because he knows he's making the call.
Right.
So the
right.
other person is always like caught on guard. You can always tell sometimes because Dave knows if the phone rings like four times, I'm over there trying to think of a really good one.
And the best is when like somebody pitches one and the other one's like, I can't even get a comeback to that one. That one's great.
Yeah. They just tap out. It's like, "All right, I'm out. Let's talk."
Yeah, like I can't even think of them. So I have to share with everybody that I actually downloaded an app, Brad. Not only download, I paid like $9 for this app for my iPhone.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to try to tell people what the app is. It's called Tape a Call Pro. And I'm going to share it because it didn't work. The damn thing didn't work. So I wanted to tape and include on a show all of Brad and my intros to each other on the phone. Because we'll call each other and go, "Well, hello, my little belt and suspenders. Well, hello, my little forbidden kiss." Whatever the phrase is that we use on each other. I was going to do a master edit of like 100 of these and include them on the show. So I bought this $9 app for my phone, Brad. Here's what you got to do. You initiate the call, and then you have to go back to the app and then say, "Okay, yes, you want to record? Yes, I do want to record. Are you sure? Yes, I do." And then that takes like 30, 40 seconds. So by the time you've gone into Brad Geiger's pitch of the day of like, "Well, hello, my sweet apple strudel with ice cream." And the other one's like, "Ah, I can't hit record in time."
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. We really tried to make that app work. And I hope you went back and left them a 1-star review.
Well, it's kind of hard to leave a review saying, like, "Listen, I greet my friend with ridiculous greetings every time I call, and I'm trying to record that, and your app does not..."
You guys are no good.
Like, that app is made for, like, attorneys that, like, need to record their client or whatever, you know, to some kind of thing, or a real estate agent that needs to get the details down. Meanwhile, me is like, "I'm trying to make a podcast about comics where I make joke, intros to my friend when I call him. And your app doesn't work for that. I'm very upset."
There's got to be a solution. I'm sure somebody's going to write in and give us a solution, but I got to figure somewhere out there something exists that does this.
Yeah, let's crowdsource that, because if you guys want to hear literally 1,000 ridiculous greetings that Brad and I give each other when we call one another.
And some of them are truly inspired because, like, if you're the person getting the call, you've got like 5 seconds, 6 seconds to come up with something. And some of them are really like out of the blue, just top, what do you call that?
Top like of impromptu. Mind, like tip of the tongue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're just like out there.
And Brad does some great seasonal ones. Like this morning, you had one about Halloween when I called you.
Yeah, my little pumpkin spice friend. And then, of course, Dave told me he was in good spirits, and we had a good little Halloween chuckle.
Two dads calling each other is what that is. Two dads calling each other. Well, on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a fool of yourself from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his sugar-coated sweet friend, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend, because we have a surprisingly big list of things to talk about today, and I'm excited to jump into the show, my friend.
Yeah, this is going to be, we've got a barn burner right ahead of us here.
So the first one that I want to talk about, Brad, came in from two backers, a husband-wife duo, Clint and Suzette. And here's the question. Can I read it to you, Brad?
Yeah, please.
It goes, can you please reiterate your business model? It seems like it is, one, give away some free comics and get a following. Two, take your fans and set up both a Patreon and a Kickstarter account, all free advertising platforms, Facebook, Twitter, etc. Three, sell a print book to your new following. Do you print your books overseas and send to Amazon? What company do you use? Brad, okay, so there's a lot of questions in there wrapped in there. But the big one, the one I think is most intriguing, because we don't cover it in large scope, and it's worth reiterating from time to time, is, Brad, what is your business model? How the heck does Brad make a living? That's what people want to know.
I'm still trying to figure it out. But listen, the first things first, we've got to start here and say that, back in the Webcomics Weekly days, we talked a lot about the Webcomics business model. Like there was one thing, and what we've got to do at the outset,
yes,
is say, listen, there's no Webcomics business model. There's a lot of different ways to do this. And Dave and I talk about something that follows very similar paths, and we endorse it strongly because it's worked for us. This is not the only way to do things, and there are other ways that are very valid. But if you're talking about the webcomics business model that Dave and I endorse and follow ourselves, it's very close to what you said, with one very important distinction. I always say on the show, your words give you away. And you used one word that showed me that you're thinking about social media in a way that I'd like to convince you otherwise. All right.
Okay.
Because you said that identified Twitter and Facebook and so forth as free advertising platforms. And that's where I want to give you a different way to think of it, because social media started out that way. Social media started out not necessarily, I don't like to use the word advertising, because advertising pretty much gives you a connotation that I've got something to sell, you've got to buy it, I'm going to tell you how to buy it or why to buy it. That's advertising.
Social media
is not advertising. It was always, in the beginning, it was very much promotion. Hey, look at me. I'm doing this thing. Maybe you'd be interested in it. It's over here. Go and take a look at it. That's how social media started.
Right.
In the last 5 years, though, social media had a big shift. People started getting the majority, if not all, of their online content through social media. Yep. So as people who do content, as creators, we had to shift too. And you've heard me talking about that on this show a lot. Social media is now a publishing system with a built-in promotion.
Right.
And that's a very, very important distinction. It means that you have to approach social media in a completely different way. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. If you're a cartoonist, if you're doing comics, I've always been promoting very forcefully that you should be putting the comic on social media so I can read it on social media, not without clicking on a link to go someplace else. I need to read it right there. And there are a lot of other ways to do it. If you're somebody who's doing something different, let's say you're an author, you're doing prose, well then your publishing might be a little bit different. You might need to find a different way to put your content out there, or a different angle. And my words to you are the same as they've always been. You got into this business because you wanted to be creative. Here's your chance. I can't tell you how to do it, but I can tell you this is a creative problem for you to solve. But if you look at Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these, if you look at them as advertising platforms, you're making a big mistake, in my opinion. You need to rethink those as publishing platforms with built-in promotion.
Yep, I co-sign that one heartily. I think that's a good delineation to make on the difference between advertising as a platform and social media as a platform. So that's a great one, Brad. And then more broadly speaking, to their question, I think the webcomics business model, as you said, Brad, I think there are many paths to that same mountain. And it is worth reiterating that both Brad and I, while we share our opinions, and some people might think like, oh, Dave and Brad think there's only one way and there's 90 ways to do it. We actually agree with you. There are 90 ways to do it. And we know that because we have friends and peers that do it 90 different ways. We really can only speak to with experience to our own business model. But we recognize that, for example, there are people that take a lot more corporate gigs than I do. There are people that take a lot more commission work than I do. There are people that do licensed art for companies. And none of those I do, all of which are a viable way to supplement or make a big part of your income.
Oh, absolutely. And as I found out, the more I got into not safe for work publishing, there's a lot of people that take a completely different tack. Like I keep all my NSFW stuff behind a paywall at Patreon. There's a lot of people that do just the opposite. They're putting it all out there, building huge followings on their social media, because obviously who doesn't want to follow that? And then they're coming back and doing more of a support model type Patreon. And if that works for you, I say, go for it. I don't know that that would work for me, but I see people doing that and it's like, good, that's valid too. Go for it. I love it. Now, one other topic before we go too farther off, one other topic, Dave, I want to circle around to, because this was a long question that I went and counted. It was a 1,000-word question that was sent in. And we would have to devote the next 3 shows to cover everything. But I want to get a couple things off the list here. And that is, they talked about printing books. And they go, CreateSpace prints our books and keeps about half our print proceeds. Well, yeah, no kidding. That's all print
on
demand.
What a course correction that was. Brad, you got through like 3/4 of the word shit and then stopped yourself. You weren't fooling anybody on that one. There's a different way to do that.
Well, we know Clint and Suzette from like the early days of KeenSpot. I mean, we go way back. So I did not want to be my grouchy self with them. But listen, we've been around long enough to know print on demand. That's the whole deal. You print one when somebody orders one. That's your safety. You don't have to buy in bulk. But the other side of print on demand is that you don't make any money. So yeah, of course, CreateSpace is a bad choice. It's always going to be a bad choice if you're looking to make money. If you're looking to test the waters, fine. But otherwise, you need to do an actual offset print run. Now, what are some good printers to use? Go to the Comic Lab Patreon page. We did a whole post that was just delineating printers and their contact information. I think if you use the tag books on the Patreon page, it'll take you to there. You might have to do a little searching for it. And unfortunately, Patreon doesn't have a really good search function yet. So I apologize. But it is there. We did post it, and it has some really good contact information for good publishers that are used to working with graphic novels and comics. So I just wanted to put that out there. There is that information, and a lot of the other stuff in your question we've addressed in previous shows, so including pro tips. So it might be worth your time to go through there and find some topics. And if we get a chance, we'll come back to some of these. But like I said, there was just no way we could get all of the questions answered that you asked.
Right. But I want to do just a real quick survey, a bird's eye picture of what Brad and I would probably say as the business model for webcomics, which is, and I want to start with the big one, which is independence. A lot of people would immediately go to GoComics or some Korean company that might have a big presence online, like Webtoons or something. Brad and I would argue for the fact that, that'll get you a big audience, but follow that through logically through the next steps, and you're going to want to maintain independence for the much larger share of an income. I would much rather have a vaster share of my income with way more control, but have a smaller audience. Now, again, that's a difference that I have with some of my peers and friends, and I think Brad shares that with me. And the reason is that has helped me over the decades of web cartooning to re-steer my audience when something big like social media, as Brad mentions, changes or comes upon the scene. And so when you control your audience, when you have direct access to your audience, when you don't have to go through some intermediate third-party company that also takes a big chunk of your profit, you're more nimble. So that, I think for me, at least in the near future, remains a big part of what I do as a web cartoonist.
The word is independence, and that's a really key part of the of what we talk about for our business model.
Yeah, and if you look at Brad and my business over the course of a year, you'll see that we partner with companies here or there doing this or that on a small basis. But all of it, all the contracts are limited. All of them are focused. All of them are terms that we like in terms of maintaining our independence. But we profit off of this or that move with them. So whether it's a t-shirt company or a distribution company or a small manufacturer of goods, those are small, short-term, limited term partnerships we go with. So independence is a big one. The other one, to your question, we do give away stuff for free. All the content is for free. And the reason why I underline this is at the end of the show, I think we also have a question about people who, the idea is once you turn someone into a fan, the implicit and sometimes explicit agreement is that once you become a fan, then you find a way to support that artist, whether it be by buying a book, a t-shirt, supporting them on Patreon or Kickstarter. That's the implicit request that Brad and I and a lot of web cartoonists make of their audience, right? So that's still the basic core idea. Advertising, for the most part, out of the picture. So it's, for the most part, transitioning fans that we got for free with free goods and transitioning them into somehow being paying customers. That's the basic model of web comics. Would you say, Brad?
Absolutely. Go back to that original How to Make Web Comics book that the four of us wrote. And Dave wrote a chapter that I still think is one of the quintessential chapters in web comics reading, if you want to understand it. And it was the chapter on community building. And that's exactly what Dave's talking about there when he's talking about, you know, building an online presence and giving content away and building a fan base. It's all about community building. And I think if you can look at your social media presence and your website and think about it in terms of what am I doing to build community? Specifically, what community am I building and where do I stand in that community? If you can do that, you've got a really good shot at building something that is self-supporting.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Brad, I'll let you jump into the next question. I think we put a good button on that one. Why don't you go ahead and jump into the next question for the show, my friend?
So, Dave, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Taking a look at your former Kickstarter, I know that you've got about 40,000 Instagram followers because I look at that number and get very jealous when I look at my 1,000. But I was wondering, when it came to a Kickstarter, how did that translate? In other words, did you get a good return on investment for 40,000 Instagram followers?
Well, that's a great question, Brad. To give some big picture bird's eye stuff on Instagram, one of the things we'd seen our friends Chris Halbeck and others, and Jake Parker, for example, grow their Instagram followings in the hundreds of thousands. And frankly, within a kind of short amount of time, you know, 6 months, 18 months, 24 months, had they grown it up north of 100,000, 200,000, 300,000. And I was like, boy, I want whatever that is. I want some of that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so I was very interested in this last year and grew my Instagram from, I don't know, 1,000 or 2,000 up to 43,000. I was like, great. Oh, that's amazing. Look at that quick growth. That's wow. Could not be easier on Instagram. And I'm glad that you asked this question because the capstone to this is thus far, you know what $43,000 and $1 gets you on Instagram, Brad? It gets you $1. That's what it gets you.
Well, now hold on. You've got statistics. How many people came over to Kickstarter from Instagram?
So I'm logged in and I'm looking at my numbers from Kickstarter. The number of people that backed the project from Instagram. And I want you to know, Brad, every comic that I posted for 30 days on Instagram had the capper image of like, hey, head over to the Kickstarter to back this book. Every story day that I ran on Instagram had swipeable, because once you get above 10,000, you can swipe for a link. Had swipeable links that people could go right over to the Kickstarter. It had the delightful videos. It had all sorts of stuff. So 43,000 people, how many do you think came over and jumped in on the Kickstarter, Brad? 43,000 people.
Well, let's see. I'm going to say, being conservative, about
5%. 5%. Yeah, that's, I mean, listen, that's not unheard of. Even 2% would be acceptable. I got 20 people, Brad, out of 43,000 people, 20 people jumped over to, I don't even know what that is in terms of percentage. It's not great, but,
how many total Kickstarter backers did you have?
I don't have, I logged out. Oh, Brad, I logged out. Why are you embarrassing me in front of the family?
Well, I think I have the answer. It's 751.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. I dumbly logged out. Why did I do that?
Because I did a little show prep, Dave. That's what we call show prep. according to my math, 20 out of 751 is 2.6%.
Of my overall pledge audience, yeah.
2% of your pledge audience came from Instagram.
So by comparison, my Twitter following has been very static, actually, for the last 5 years. It's been pretty consistently around 9,000. I can't grow the damn thing to save my life. However, it is a much more vociferous back and forth and much more engaged audience on Twitter. I got something like 40 to 90. I don't remember now that I've logged out, but it was much higher than Instagram. Given the fact that there are 43 versus 9,000 people, you should have a much higher number on Instagram. Nope, not the case. Now, logical arguments that you can make. Kickstarter backers tend to be the ones that have been following for a long time. You've earned their trust, right? You've not only their trust, you've earned their passion, right? And so if I've grown this 43,000 people in the last year that quickly, they're still coming to love the work that I do. There might not be, they might not have fully drank the Kool-Aid yet. So I get that only 20 of them have backed. But
yeah.
I just want to put this out there, Brad, especially in light of the settlement that Facebook had to make last month for basically lying about video stats. You probably saw the settlement. I mean, people at College Humor legitimately said that Facebook ruined their business because they transitioned based entirely on the numbers that Facebook was giving out, saying, "Oh, your videos are doing amazing." So College Humor went in big on Facebook. And sure enough, Facebook was inflating their numbers by something like 900%, right? And these are all court release numbers. These are not numbers I'm coming up with. So I a little bit wonder, Brad, there's a tiny part of my heart that's like, is Instagram a lie? How many of these are non-existent or fake followers? Or because it grew awfully fast to 43, and yet I'm only transitioning 20 people. So there's a tiny part of my heart that's like, well, A, maybe the fandom's not there yet. That's entirely possible emotionally that they're not ready to back a Kickstarter. But B, a part of me is like, how many of these people are real? That's another one, you know?
Well, and so I agree with that, that's the first thing I thought when I saw that Facebook settlement. But there's a couple of thoughts I also had, to be fair, and also to make sure that we're not missing something. So out of that Kickstarter, how many people, and you don't have to upload this, but you can just say it in like broad sweeping terms. Would it be safe to say that the majority of them came from your website?
Oh, yeah. So that's the big takeaway that we should have. And this kind of goes back to independence, I guess, Brad.
Yeah.
Is that my sites, Drive and Sheldon, continue to be the major driver of people to taking action on my requests, like, hey, buy my book, or hey, get this t-shirt, or hey. So for the Kickstarter campaign, it was in the hundreds of people that came from the websites, not from social media. That tells me a lot, which is that even in this world of being mobile and being social media and being, you know, everything's got to be an app and everything's got to be phone friendly, that old website is still driving a lot of traffic towards my being able to make a living for my career. And what are your thoughts on that, Brad? Why might that still be the case, do you think?
I'm going to yes and you. Yes, okay. And you cannot, yes, and how many of those people discovered the website through social media? In other words, the piece of the puzzle that that would be a mistake, in my opinion, to leave out would be, yes, same as me, I still see my website as a huge driver of traffic to Patreon and Kickstarter. But when I go into Google Analytics and take a look at my website traffic, I see that social media is a huge driver of traffic to my website.
Right, right. That's
so
true.
The thing that you've got to keep in mind, it would be really easy, in my opinion, it would be really easy to take a look at stuff like this and say, well, that's it. Social media is a crock. Like we had a backer a months ago. It's fool's gold. It's all crap. I can understand that. I totally get that. And as somebody who is thrilled to be knocking on the door of 2,000 after 2 years, of Instagram and take a look at your 40,000. I totally get the frustration. However, I think it would be a mistake to not take a big picture look at this and say, yeah, okay, 2% of my Kickstarter backers came directly from Instagram. Most of them came from my website, but go back and look at your website numbers. How much traffic are you getting from social media to your website? And
right,
if you were to take a social media sucks aspect to that, I think you might risk doing yourself some harm. And the other thing that this brings up is this discussion that we've had before on the show about organic results versus inorganic results on social media. Inorganic is when you pay for content, all right?
Right.
Or when you pay to boost a post and stuff like this. It's when you pay the social media to get your message out there further. Organic is just the people who are following you because they want to follow you, and they're engaging because they want to engage, and it's slower and it's more tedious. It's a more slow build. However, I will take organic reach over inorganic reach every day of the week. I'll take a smaller audience. I'll take a smaller engagement of real people over a larger audience of inorganic people who may or may not be interested in what I'm doing, and an inorganic engagement. We had a great discussion on the Discord channel on this, and it had to do with something by which somebody paid for emails for a newsletter. And it was all legit. I was very skeptical. I'm always skeptical about this stuff. It was very legit. It was up and up. It was above board, but it didn't have the return that this member was expecting. And it just reinforces for me, I'll take organic every time. The numbers are smaller. It's a lot slower growth.
Yep.
But
yep.
Every time, organic beats inorganic. Every time.
Well, and this goes straight to those Kickstarter numbers that I mentioned, Brad, is that it's provable. And I mean, am I aware as a thinking adult that I sound a little tinfoil on the head when I'm like, I don't know if Facebook's lying about these numbers. Yes, I'm aware of that. Like it's big corn. They're trying to get you with the corn syrup, Brad. That's what. I recognize that I sound like a little crazy conspiracy theorist, but I just feel like recent history is a little bit bearing out the truth of the fact that a lot of people are trying to grow their social media networks by either allowing bots passively and bot networks and fake accounts because it helps grow their numbers, or maybe even actively, as in the case of this most recent court case with video stuff.
Yeah.
With Facebook. It's a little bit of Theranos. It's a little bit of WeWork. It's all these companies that are trying to gin up the fact, like, look how successful we are, when nothing is, there's no there because it's all inorganic and a lot of it is botted networks or fake people or that kind of thing. So to Brad's point, the safer route and the one that we advise is remain independent, and also that organic stuff, traffic is way more productive for your career than the inorganic stuff. So I a little bit feel like in 5 years, we're all going to find out that Twitter and Facebook, a lot of these numbers were either ginned up either passively acceptingly from the company or actively from the companies. Is there an audience there? Absolutely. Yes, of course there's an audience there. It'd be ridiculous to say no. And to Brad's point, you would be ridiculous to walk away from it. For example, I'm still going to try to grow my Instagram to 100,000 because I still want to see what I could do with that kind of reach. Now, but what I'm saying is it is largely inorganic, and I've already seen that maybe the results are harder to nudge to any monetary result than it would be with an organic reach on a website with a longstanding fan. So I go in basically with eyes wide open about what the results probably will be in growing my Instagram to 100,000.
Absolutely. Hey, If you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics.
Well, once again, Brad and our friends, our question askers out there, this week's Comic Lab is brought to you by the good folks over at Wacom at WACOM.com. Brad and I both have them in the studio, both use them, both love them, both make a huge part of our careers. So it could not be a better sponsor for the show. It's kind of a match made in heaven, Brad. I love it. We've talked about it before. We've joked about it. But it's like, hey, Comic Lab this week brought to you by a drawing desk. literally an item that you use every day.
That's right.
So anyway, it was really fun that Wacom reached out and wanted to sponsor the show because we legit love them. We use them all the time. And it is fantastic that they wanted to support the comics community by helping to support this podcast. So thank you, Wacom, over at WACOM.com. Brad Geiger, what do we got for the next part of the show? Go, my friend.
I don't want to talk about the next part of the show. I want to talk about the first part of the show still.
Wait, what? All right, go ahead.
I've got my hack. Oh, okay, so here's the deal. Everything we said about social media was spot on. And the breaking news about Facebook having to pay, what is it, a $40 million fine, which for them is a slap on
is
the wrist.
Is a drop in the hat. Yeah, it's nothing.
It's a laughable. But there's one thing that really bothers me about this. Okay. This news comes out that Facebook was artificially inflating its numbers, and Adam Conover, who's that Adam Ruins Everything guy, my kids love him. Adam from College Humor. He starts tweeting about it, and he says, "My former employer, College Humor, did this. In other words, in order to beat YouTube, Facebook faked incredibly viewership numbers. So College Humor pivoted to Facebook." And what he goes on to say, and you can read it all at Adam Conover, 1N, over on Twitter. He lays it all out, how College Humor pivoted to Facebook from YouTube, and they were making tons of money, but they pivoted. They used to have ad executives and people that were making special commercial content for sponsors. They were doing great, right? On YouTube,
right.
They pivoted to Facebook and everything dried up. My question for you, Dave, is I get that they made a wrong turn. How come they kept driving down the road? Don't you think at some point before they fire their last ad executive, before they let the last commercial creative go out the door, they say, wait a minute, this isn't working. Let's go back
wait,
to what we were
should
doing
change
before.
Tax, for God's sake. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Brad, hold on. I got to pause the show. I just drank a shot of Windex. Oh, no. What did I do? Oh, no, Brad, I'm still drinking it. Why can't I stop drinking this Windex?
Dave, stop drinking the Windex. It's
no
good
Brad,
for
I've
you.
Made a commitment to the Windex now. I've got to keep going.
Put the Windex down, Dave. I'll admit your breath is better this way, but still, don't drink the Windex.
No, but listen, one of my, you have a couple like Bradisms that you say that I really stick with me because they're true. They have the benefit of being true, but they're also incredibly insightful. And one of them is, if you've made a mistake, don't keep making it just because you've made the mistake over a long period of time.
Listen, if you're going to quote me, would you do it right?
I know, I really murdered that, didn't I, as a buddy? I'm sorry, a buddy? Why did I say buddy again? That's twice now I've said buddy. Am I becoming an old dentist? Oh, God.
Listen, if you're going to quote me, it goes like this. Don't stick with a mistake just because it took you a long time to make it.
There, oh, God. All right, well, I've been your podcast co-host, and I'm quitting because I could not have mangled that more. Oh, I could not have.
Holy cats.
I think what Einstein meant is E equals sometimes maybe the M with a C if it's squared, but only if the conditions are right. And then you're like, no, it's just E equals MC squared. Oh, all right. Yeah, let's just say that.
Thanks for rewording that for Albert. That's much better.
Wow, I murdered that, Brad. I really murdered that. And after my big talk of like, well, one of the reasons why I love Brad is he makes it pithy and sweet and delicious.
You did such a beautiful talk up and just flew right off the edge of the cliff.
Yeah. Well, Brad, you remember what Shakespeare said that one time. Romeo, Romeo, hey, are you around here anywhere? Can I find you somewhere? Are you local? Just give a shout out if you're here. Hey, Romeo. But listen.
Go ahead. To get back to
your central point, and I do share the piss and vinegar that you have about this.
Yeah.
Is that it is funny when some of these tech companies go, and we believed in Facebook and we kept going. And it's like, well, listen, you just laid off 30% of your staff. Maybe think about it again.
Yeah.
Okay, now you've laid off 60% of your staff. Really give it a good think. Why are you doing Facebook? Now you've laid off 90% of your staff. Why don't you go back to doing it the way you were doing before?
Yeah. If it was so good, it's not like YouTube dried up. It's like not like they shut the door behind you. You just say, oh, guess what, everybody? We're going to go over and do this now.
Yeah. But in the broader picture, though, Brad, doesn't this speak to the point that we made at the beginning of the show in terms of webcomics business model,
which is
maintain your independence and don't become reliant on some other company that's going to promise you the world and then take a big chunk of your income and or not deliver, you know?
And don't get distracted by big numbers. Because I really do think, Dave, the reason they stayed with Facebook is because they were getting big numbers.
Right. I think you're right. I think it appealed to a basic ego, Brad. Well, we can't leave now. We're getting $500,000 as soon as the video goes up every hour, you know.
And they couldn't see the fact that was not translating into money. They just wanted those big numbers. It all came down to, you know, measuring their numbers. And it's like, don't fall into that trap as a creator, as an independent creator. Don't get tricked by big numbers. Sometimes big numbers are just numbers. What you want is to measure the actual return on investment, measure the money that's coming in, and know that webcomics has proven one thing over and over, over 20 years, you can make more money from a smaller audience if you're actually doing the work and connecting with that audience.
Connecting with them directly and controlling what gets said to them directly so that there's no third party intermediary saying, hey, maybe do it this way, maybe do it that way. Hey, say it this way or say it that way or don't say it at all. Like when Brad and I can talk directly to our audience, control what we give them and have complete and utter access. That's where we succeed. And to Brad's point, I'd rather have 10,000 people that are super core readers than have 100,000 people that are like, I have to reach them by weird means and I can't completely communicate with them and they can't completely see all my links unless I pay some algorithm.
Yeah. And half of them aren't really there and half of them don't know why they're following you in the first place. Didn't know how they got signed up.
you only appear on their feed once every 4 weeks and you're like, you know, so... Yeah. So anyway, long story short, Grandpa and Grandpa over here are not so sold on some of the newfangled ways of doing it. But no, it's just that we've seen results. I'll a little bit tip our hand to an upcoming thing, which is that a podcasting journalist had asked us, hey, you guys do your podcasting differently than other people. And Brad, we hadn't talked about this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway.
No,
I'm not going
to
reveal too much.
But the basic idea is this.
The podcast journalist was saying, hey, most people go for the huge, big launch on Apple Podcasts because that's the way you do it. That's the way everybody does it on podcasts. You get the huge, big launch, and then you translate that into advertisers, and that's how you make the money, right?
Yeah, and the other part of that step was go for the subscribers. You got to pound away. Get subscribed.
You got to get them to subscribe on your podcast because that counts towards your numbers, and then that counts towards advertising.
Yes.
Whereas Brad and I, our attitude was, he was like, you guys do it so differently. And Brad and my attitude was, no, we're going to get a smaller audience, but we're going to get people that truly love and value the show and get value out of it. And in return are like, you know what? For the price of a coffee, yes, I will back this podcast on Patreon.
Yes.
You think, Brad?
Plus exclusive content. Plus, you
right.
Get, so we monetized it that way. We started with, we're going to do a good show. We're going to do a good show for people who are in this specific category. We're going to give them that show. Some of them are going to support it because they like what we're doing. Some of them are going to support it because they like the exclusive content. And that's how we monetize it. We don't have amazing subscription numbers because, like I told the guy, that doesn't matter to us in the slightest. I said, okay, take a look at Apple Podcast. Type in webcomics for Apple Podcast, and you will see Comic Lab in the first round of returns. You'll also see a couple of podcasts that haven't updated since 2017. You'll see a bunch
of... And it had three shows to begin with, you know? They had three episodes.
And a bunch of... And some of them appear ahead of us, on right?
Right.
And we've got, I think, at last count, 187 ratings. And by the way, if you love us, you don't want to spend any money, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. That's a great way. But here's the other part of why that is kind of weird for me. And that is, on that same search result, somebody's going to appear ahead of Comic Lab that has 5 ratings, that has 100 ratings, and hasn't updated since 2015. So I looked at that after a year of launching Comic Lab. I looked at that and I said, I'm not spending any more time on this. I was, for a while, yeah, it was like, I got to use keywords, and I've got to figure out what keywords I'm using. And sometimes I'm going to do this keywords, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. And I'm reading how these posts, these articles, how to do better on that. Finally, I looked at it and I said, this is bullshit. there's no part of this I want anything to do with. And we're just going to do a good show. We're going to put it out. We're going to make it available. Same as a webcomic. Anywhere you can pick it up, we're going to put it there. We're going to build our revenue stream through people doing crowdfunding like Patreon and Kickstarter. We're going to build supporters that way. Now, can I tell them the next thing that we found out?
Sure, sure.
Oh,
so we might as well go whole hog and reveal this whole conversation.
Yeah,
we haven't talked about it, but why not?
We didn't sign no NDAs. We're going. So here's what we found out. This is fascinating. This is fascinating. And it's been on my mind ever since. So here's what we found out. He goes, here's the thing. They've already got software that they're developing. It's already out in some places that will listen to a podcast and strip the ads out of a podcast. The same way an ad stripper works on a website.
An ad blocker.
The same way that works, it can listen to that. And when it detects a different sound than the host's voices, they strip it out. So it'll be harder to strip out like somebody reading a live ad or something like that. But an ad that was canned that just gets inserted, they're going to strip that right out. And when that happens, these podcasters who were relying on subscriptions and ratings and all of that stuff, they're going to go bust because their entire business model is going to go toes up. And I looked at Dave, and Dave looked at me, and I said, holy cats. Podcasting is going to go through what webcomics went through 5 or 7 years ago. They're going to have the same thing, and they're going to have to come around to the same place that we did. But Dave and I are already, with how we're handling this podcast, 5 years ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Well, and Brad and I were more flummoxed by, sometimes, Brad, you can benefit by not knowing what the quote unquote tried and true way to do a thing is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So Brad and I just took the webcomics model and tried to apply it to podcasting. Now, listen, by the way, Brad and I, it's not like we're buying a solid gold car off Comic Lab. We're still growing it. We have like a 5-year plan for this, and we're nowhere near it yet. But anyway, regardless, what I'm getting at here is—
But that goes back to what we said, slow growth. That's where it is.
Yeah, and organic growth, organic slow growth. Where we know each follower is an actual follower and they are committed to the show. Anyway, what I'm getting at though is that I was particularly fascinated, Brad, when we were talking to this journalist. He's like, no, the way that these big companies, and I'm not going to throw them under the bus, but let's just say really big magazine companies that partnered with a really big star to launch a podcast, right? Like they were spending tens of thousands on a podcast.
Yeah.
But if it didn't get a day one or a weekend one huge launch on Apple Podcasts, the show was dead. Like they couldn't find a way. It's kind of like a movie opening weekend. They couldn't find a way to grow it if it didn't have that big opening weekend.
Right.
Whereas Brad and I were always like, start small, start putting stuff out there, just like a webcomic. make it consistent quality and on a schedule people can fairly rely on.
Yeah.
And then grow the audience from there with word of mouth and with, you know, or organic growth that we can spread on our own sites and on social media, and embed this software everywhere. Let it make it very freeable. You don't have to subscribe. Just listen to it wherever it's most convenient to you.
Yeah.
Right. And apparently that's totally foreign to podcasting, the big companies. So they have to have this big first day launch. They have to bring in star power because that's the way to do it. And then they grow it so that with a subscriber base, they got to push subscriptions because then they can use the subscriptions to go out to sell advertising, which can then place ads on the show, which then trickles down to the podcast host getting some money.
Right.
Whereas Brad and I were like, our two-part plan was make show, collect money. That was our two-part plan.
It seems so simple.
looking at it from a bird's eye, we look like idiots. Like make show, make money. That's what our goal was going to be.
We're kind of like a bumblebee. If you look at us from an aerodynamic sense, we really shouldn't get off the ground.
That really describes our business model. But I, if you remember, Brad, I kept going back to the journalist, going like, "Wait, yeah. How do they? What do they do if they don't have a big launch?" He's like, "Well, they die. The podcasts die all the time. It's a really big turnover."
Yeah,
and so it's like, the same 100 podcasts on Apple Podcasts all the time because the algorithm really rewards that huge subscription base that like a Joe Rogan show has or something like that. So
right.
You see that one highly populating the top 100 kind of a thing.
Yeah, it really was amazing.
Yeah, it was a real big eye opener. And frankly, I like our method better, Brad, because we're not reliant on any one platform. We can say, listen to the show wherever you want to listen to it. And then once you've found that you've got enough value out of it and that you want the extra content that we put on Patreon and you want the community and the discounts and all the other stuff that we can put on Patreon, maybe kick in a couple of bucks and support the show. And
yeah.
And I like that that's the model for this because I feel like it's kind of reaffirming that the other podcast model, especially with ads being stripped out, is going to start going with the problem route that YouTube had with the YouTubers, you know?
Yeah. Well, our way is better. Our backers can back us for a month and then drop out. Like nobody yep. expects you, if you're a Patreon backer, to be a backer for 3 years or anything more than a month. If you want to back us for a month and then drop out, fine. In fact, good on you. Nobody has a problem with a short-term backer. And if you want to come back after you do that, great. It's such a low impact kind of thing. It there's really no risk. And that's what makes it so good. And the other thing that we've got to mention, Dave, that we learned that put us on the radar is that there's
right.
an enormous amount of people who are listening to this podcast on one of our websites. They're listening to the embedded show.
Right.
And this made this guy's eyes spin around in his head.
The journalist was like blown away. He's like, nobody does this in podcasts. You don't share your podcast on your website embedded. He goes, you got to get subscribers. And
yeah.
Brad and I were like, "It to us, it seemed like a 15-part plan to getting someone to listen to your show
yeah.
versus ours, which is just like, put the show anywhere people are. Just put it out there and you'll get people. It's like webcomics.
Right.
Put it on Facebook, put it on Twitter, put it on Instagram, put it on your website. And that's what we do with the podcast. And it's fascinating that same model was like apparently hugely world changing from what podcasting normally does.
Yeah. And it also shows what we always say, even when websites went over their big shift and things went to social media, we still said, keep that website. You always need your website for a hub. Yeah, you're going to do this on it. You're going to do that on it. The fact that we've kept our websites and made our websites hub for our material, even though we do publishing on social media, has brought back benefits in all kinds of ways, including this way that we weren't even aware of until we looked at it. It's
right,
always,
right.
I'm all for putting a mirror site up on Webtoons, for example, and any other place you can put it, I'm for it. But, oh man, I can't tell you how beneficial it's been to keep that website as a hub of all of my activities.
Right, right. And that's why it's interesting how even in the podcasting world, there are parallels to webcomics, which is GoComics or Webtoons might say, nope, come be with us, be our exclusive kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like podcasting where those podcasting networks will scoop you up and be like, don't worry, kid, we're going to handle everything for you. You just make a pretty show.
Oh, my God.
And we're going to look at this lovely shoes we got you in this pretty dress. You're going to look fantastic.
Yeah, made them right out of concrete.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And that could work for some people, and I'm sure it has worked. But I think for the vast majority of podcasts, much like webcomics, you would be better off staying independent, maintaining your own site, maintaining the ability to put it wherever your listeners are, and being nimble. And so, again, this goes back to that basic webcomics business model that we propose. And I think Brad, it kind of works for podcasting too.
Well, yeah. Well, again.
I mean, I'm prepared to be super wrong about that, but I my gut tells me that we're on the right path there.
Here's the thing that keeps getting, this is the word of the day today, and that's independence. In other words, if you're doing it that way, somebody makes a dumb decision like, hey, we're going to send all of our content to Facebook. They make a dumb decision. They can sink you, and the decision not to go back is not yours, and that's going to sink you. I've made 110 dumb decisions. They were all mine, and I was able to correct them as soon as I realized I had made them. That's
right.
What we talk about when we talk about staying independent and staying nimble and paying attention to what you're doing. Mistakes are going to happen all the time. We've said all the time on this show, mistakes are where you learn. You got to make mistakes and you got to correct them and you got to come back from. That's why I'm always going to be fiercely independent. I could not imagine being in a college humor situation where somebody made a dumb decision and is bound to determine they're going to stay with that decision until the whole ship sinks. That would make me crazy.
And now you, Brad Geiger, having signed up with College Humor, are now wedded to that mistake, and you, seeing the mistake for what it is, can't nimbly jump away. You're like, nope, I signed this contract. I guess I'm with
them. Oh, and Dave, I haven't told you about this. We haven't even talked about this. So somebody who is signed up with one of these web conglomerates for comics gets in touch. So I'm not going to name him. Gets in touch with me, and he says, hey, I'm having a really hard time getting traction. And he's like an exclusive. I'm having a hard time getting traction with this comic. I'm like, well, let me see it. I'll take a look at it. I'll give you 10 minutes. You know, I can't do a full consultation because I sell those, but I'll look at it and give you a blush, right? And he starts out and he starts out with this whole world building dump that takes about 6 panels that are nothing but text. And I'm like, this is horrible. I'd never read it. I'm out by the first page. You got to fix that. It's too much exposition. And it's all exposition for stuff that doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the chapter. It's all exposition that's going to be important someday. But it's certainly not keep your readers on a need-to-know basis like I always preach. I'm like, this is horrible. He goes, nah, the editor wanted that. And we can't change it. The editor insists that it's there. I'm like, can you get out of your contract? He goes, no, that's not an option. I said, you're fucked. End of consultation. But I didn't actually say that. But I was like, oh God, okay, we got to. But I could not imagine being in a situation not only where they're making bad business decisions. Now I got somebody making bad creative decisions who clearly doesn't have the same outlook on publishing that I do, and I got hand shackled by it.
Well, and that's listen. This is now we're just becoming grumpy about it. But part of it is like I'm like Brad in that I don't like, and I left the corporate world because I don't like it. I don't like being told what to do editorially.
Yeah.
I would rather make my own mistake and own it than make a mistake because someone forced me to make a mistake. And that nothing drives me more bonkers than like a thing failed because someone told me to do XYZ and it didn't work out. Now.
Right.
I can do that because I have come to trust my abilities and trust my own editorial eye. And I know sometimes to even amend what I want to do for what needs to be done. Right. And Brad does the same.
Yeah.
But that being said, like I got a freelance job the other day it was for a lot of money and I turned it down because I was like, nah, there's a lot of editorial notes on this. I don't want to do this. Like my heart would not be happy. There was literally 3 layers of approvals that I would have to go through. I was like, nah, that's
Screw
not
that.
Worth the 10 grand. I don't want it. No, I don't want to do this. I'm out. I turned it down and it's like, there's a reason why I left corporate life, and it's largely that kind of decision-making where the creativity is given over to someone else, and if a thing succeeds or fails, it's not because I did it, it's because the notes that were given, and I don't like that.
Oh, yeah, because all of a sudden you're doing creativity by committee, and you know what a camel is. That's a horse that was designed by committee.
Yep, absolutely. So let's go, speaking of horse design by committee, let's go to our last question for the show, my friend.
Right.
And this comes in from Eric Campling, and Eric writes, Dad and Brave. God, I did it again. Brad and Dave.
We're just going to have to just change our names to Dad and Brave. Do I get to be Dad or do I get to be Brave?
You know that list of Disney Plus movies that they've been releasing couple of days about movies from the 70s? We're a bad 70s Disney movie called Dad and Brave.
That's Brave.
What we are. So Eric writes, this question regards education and training, since you are both educators and educated, trainers and trained in this particular profession. Aside from listening to the fantastic podcast like Comic Lab, thank you, Eric, should an aspiring second career cartoonist or illustrator seek formal education like an MFA? And when should a cubicle groundhog by day consider applying to a SCAD, a CCS, or a RISD, or some other relevant program versus seeking out targeted topical adult education classes, online tutorials and programs, or just practicing on their own to get better? And regardless of the formality, what would you recommend for continuing professional development for artists and or writers? Brad, this is a great question from Eric. A lot of layers on this. So one thing to I think off the bat that we should talk about is that Eric is not asking as a 19-year-old or a 20, like, I just finished high school. Do I go to art school? Like, that's not Eric's question. It's more of the, listen, I've got a day job. I'm in my cubicle. I'm plugging away. But how do I, education-wise, attempt to help my career and transition into becoming a full-time artist?
Yeah.
And that is a unique kind of a question. So, Brad, why don't you jump in on that one first?
Wow. Should an aspiring second career cartoonist seek a formal education? And if so, when should they do that? The answer is no and never. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making... Oh, I'm sorry. Is that not the end of the show?
You know what? I stayed quiet despite wanting to laugh because I wanted to see how far you were going to take that.
Oh, when you went quiet, I thought I really ticked you off.
As a friend, I was like, I am here for this joke and I'm going to let it run its course.
Okay, well, listen, and I should say this at the outset. I found out a number of my students from University of the Arts listen to this show. So I just want to say you should turn the show off right now. No, I'm teasing. So here's the thing. Here's my thoughts on formal education. If I were guiding somebody who was going into this sort of thing, I would want them to have some formal art education. In other words, just somebody who could teach them the basics of sequential art, how to use a gutter, how to do lettering. That's something that, like, a couple of classes, you could get right up to speed on that. But I don't know that I would want you to have an MFA. I wouldn't want you to be a master of fine arts for that. That's the sort of thing that you're going to learn by doing. And the more you do it, the more you're going to learn. What I would be much more interested in seeing you do is to do writing classes, because in almost all forms of comics, except for a couple of exceptions, the writing is way more important than the art. And this is where sometimes I get disappointed when I see comics from art school students, because they all are what I call beautiful bores. They're beautiful comics. They're gorgeous. They're well drawn. They're well designed. They don't mean a thing. They don't say a thing. There's nothing there.
Right.
They're beautiful bores, right?
That's also how Brad describes me, just so you know.
I do. I never knew
so
you knew that.
So sometimes when we pick up the phone, he goes, well, hello, my beautiful boar. That's what he says.
but I would want you to take a lot of classes directing your writing. And of course, I would want to see you take a lot of classes in business and statistics, especially understanding statistics and marketing. And so if I were directing you, I would be probably directing you towards like a liberal arts type of university where you could get a copious amount of all of that. And whether you wanted to major in writing or major in one of those business-related aspects is up to you. But I would say that the emphasis would be in one of those, a minor in art or some art classes. And if you are going to an art school like University of the Arts, you should get, number one, your art school absolutely, positively should be offering business classes. If not, I've got a real moral problem with that. And given the landscape of the last 20 years, your art school needs to be offering business classes at University of the Art. It's called the Corso Center.
You and I have both reached out and had conversations with art schools saying, you need to do this, and nothing comes of it. But we both had a conversation. But anyway, go keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. So find out where your art school is offering this. If not, demand that they do, because it is way, way important. And then work on your writing. Understand narrative structure. Understand archetypes. Understand how to make a GD point. That's the stuff that's going to make your comics good. The physical aspect, the drawing, the design, the lettering, that you're going to gain by doing it and making mistakes and getting some guidance here or there and continuing to do it. You're going to continue to improve. That stuff is going to happen. But that other stuff is going to impact you for not knowing it a lot more directly than some of that other stuff. So I'd tell you that you should be working, majoring on writing and business. What do you think? Am I off base there, Dave?
No, I'm. It's interesting how closely aligned we are on this. So for a 20-year-old that asked me, I'm going to do this one first, and then I'm going to talk about someone who's already established in life, and if that's okay, Brad. So for a 20-year-old who asked me about art school, I very often say, just like Brad, instead of art school, maybe really strongly consider a liberal arts education rather than art school. And a point that I would make that differs a little bit from Brad is because a liberal arts education, you learn how to learn. And that is a critical aspect towards modern life, which is a liberal arts education teaches you how to teach yourself or how to incisively find a data set or a new set of facts and go, wait a minute, how can I look what's behind this data set or what's behind this new set of facts to get to a truism, right? And so a liberal arts education does a really good job of grounding you with all the great basic ideas of modern life, and then also teaches you how to learn on your own. It like sets you up. And so like Brad, I would say by all means, supplement that with art classes, supplement it with business classes, supplement with a lot of writing classes. I think all that is great. And then I would say, and one of the reasons I say that is because cartooning, and I think we're specifically talking about cartooning here. Cartooning, unlike landscape painting, unlike sculpture in marble, which takes sometimes years of teacher-student work together to get really good at a thing. Cartooning, some of the best cartoonists in the world had a skill set which no art school in the world would be happy to have produced.
Absolutely.
Like, you look at James Thurber from The New Yorker, and if you don't know Thurber, take a second to Google him real quick. Thurber. Now, the reason why I bring him up is he is inarguably one of the worst artists who has ever lived.
Legally blind.
Legally blind, yeah.
Have you ever seen pictures of him drawing? He had to have his nose pressed right up against the and he had to use these huge boards to draw on. He could not see what he was doing, and his art shows it.
Yeah. In a way, it's a lot like Callahan, Brad, wouldn't you say? Do you remember Callahan, the quadriplegic cartoonist who drew with his teeth? And also amazing, by the way. Callahan is all like Thurber, also amazing. And what I'm getting at here is, and one of the things why Brad was saying is that with cartooning, with comics, the writing carries an ever so slightly heavier load than the art does. It's kind of 60, 40, 70, 30, something like that. So you can have a tremendous writing ability, but a so-so art, and I'll just be fair about it, like a Gary Larson, who had a great style, delightful. I love to read it. Let's all be honest about it, though. Not the greatest artist. Thurber, a terrible artist. Callahan, a terrible artist. Dilbert looks like it was, traced 99% of the time. And yet they've all made a career about it because the writing is slightly more important. So that's why Brad and I think focus on the writing more than the art. And granted, we are two guys that come from more of a writing background than an art background. But if you want to be an illustrator, I think that is a slightly different path and I think might require a little more hands-on teaching and education. But also, a lot of this is the reminder, Eric, that no matter who you are, no matter when you're starting, it's a 5 to 10, and maybe emphasis on the 10 year journey.
Yeah.
And no matter what a teacher teaches you, if you're not drawing every day, if you're not writing every day, then it's going to take you longer. So you mm-hmm. are the ultimate progenitor of the success or failure of your career. And so I promise you, because I have a very dear friend who's doing this right now, started about 4 or 5 years ago being like, I'm going to post a drawing every day. And I have watched them get better and better and better and better online.
It's
no teachers,
delightful.
No online courses. They just are drawing every day. And it's like, that's what it takes. That's just what it takes. And as you get better in your skill set, like, for example, Brad, I now know what I lack in art, and I try mm-hmm. to seek out the resources, whether it be online courses or books or YouTube videos, that can teach me what I lack. And that goes back to a liberal arts education, that you learn how to learn. You learn where to seek out the knowledge or the skill set that you need or what you lack. So now I've gone on too long-winded. Brad, take it from here.
No. At the end of the day, it's impossible to get worse at something you do every day.
Oh, that's another Bradism that I would have murdered had I said it. Let me Dave Kellidify that.
It's really
hard to get less good at a thing that you continue to do day in and day out as you practice the thing.
You did a great job on that. Now let's see what you do with this. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your host have been my sweet little pumpkin of love, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my pumpkin latte laced David Kellett, the so-so co-director of Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the sponsor again for the show this week and all the way through the rest of 2019, the good folks over at Wacom at WACOM.com. Go check them out. And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode and all episodes was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we're going to go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab. Well, goodbye, my little vampire in the night.
Well, good night, my little lacy lingerie of love.
You win.